You're listening to the best of Halford and Brough.
On a Friday. Happy Friday, everybody. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Brough of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. We are in hour one of the program. Hour one is brought to you by North Star Metal Recycling. Vancouver's premier metal recycler pays the highest prices on scrap metal. North Star Metal Recycling, they recycle, you get paid. Visit them at 1170 Powell Street in Vancouver. We're waiting on Luke, is that correct? Oh, we've got him on the line. Terrific. Let's go to the phone lines now. Joins us every week here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Former NHLer, now NHL analyst Luke Gazdick here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Morning, Luke. How are you?
Good, guys. How you doing today?
We're well. Thanks for taking the time to do this. We're spending a lot of time talking about your former team, the Edmonton Oilers, as it pertains to the Vancouver Canucks, of course, because that race for top spot in the Pacific Division is still very much up for grabs. The Oilers play tonight. They've got Arizona at home. Unsure if Connor McDavid's going to play in that one. Knobloch said he's a game-time decision, but if it was a playoff game, he would certainly be playing. And then, of course, it's the Canucks and Oilers on Hockey Night Canada Saturday night, a very big game. Your thoughts on what the Oilers have to do here, because it's not just these two games back-to-back. They have a very busy schedule over the final week of the regular season.
Yeah, they do. Five games coming up left for them. It's not incredibly challenging. I don't want to count anybody out. Arizona's been playing spoiler, but AZ twice. They have the Sharks, obviously massive game versus Vancouver on Saturday. And if it, depending on what happens in that game, I really think it comes down to the last game for them on the road in Denver. But honestly, they've been playing really well at home. I know Vegas was missing a number of starters the other night, but they played a really, really good team game without McDavid. Stuart Skinner looks good. And you know what? They're playing a really good brand of hockey. I think it's all kind of based whether Connor will be back in the fold or not. But they've been playing really well at home since the deadline. They're 7-1. They just seem to feel more comfortable on home ice. But the team looks good. They're starting to get some scoring from all over their lineup. And obviously the top guys are going.
Who would be the toughest matchup for them in the first round of the ones that are possible?
Man, you know what? I don't love LA. I mean, I haven't counted against them all year, but the thing about LA, this is number three. This would be 3 years in a row for Edmonton and LA. And I don't want to say it even out loud, but I feel like at one point, LA is going to break through here. Mm-hmm. The way they play, the style of game they play can be very frustrating to play against. I know the Canucks haven't had great luck against them either this year. But I'll probably lean LA. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens here, because I know you guys know how this is going to lay out, right? If Edmonton wins out, they need a regulation win versus the Canucks on Saturday. But that could change the whole dynamic of this. But right now it's looking like LA, and I'm not going to lie, I don't love the matchup.
How would you describe the way that the Kings play? Because there's a lot of people in Vancouver that are very excited for the Canucks to be back in the playoffs, but they don't want the Canucks to play the Kings because they want exciting hockey in the playoffs.
So I played in this style. I played for Todd McClellan, who obviously doesn't coach there anymore, but he set the groundwork for what LA is doing. And my last year in Edmonton, I played for Todd, and it's a very passive 1-3-1. It can change throughout the game, depending on even where the puck is at a certain point in the ice. But for the most part, if you don't have a step on a guy or if you are on the defensive side, you're always sitting back. And so as a winger, for me, I played left wing. You're in that three line in the neutral zone. And it's very passive. And for me, I personally didn't like it. I loved taking the leash off and going forechecking. It was crazy because the year before we played, I played for Todd Nelson, who had taken over halfway through the year. Mm-hmm. He's Calder Cup champion coach in Hershey last year, and he played a 2-1-2. So it was really aggressive, two forwards on the puck. And I went from playing that to playing Todd's style. And I'll tell you, that's my perspective from playing in it, is it can be fairly boring. And one thing about it is you need all five cogs to be going. Like, every single guy needs to be doing their job on the ice in order for it to be, for it to work. Mm-hmm. It's extremely disciplined. They play the last defenseman very far back. So all they're going to try to do is cut you off, angles in the neutral zone, force you to chip it, and then their D is playing way back. And mm-hmm. then it's transition game. Vancouver's had a challenging time against it this year. It certainly is not fun to watch. You guys know that. Like, it's a good thing they play late. I throw them on to go to bed usually at night because it puts me to sleep. But it works. And it's not like some revolutionary hockey system. It's just, playing the defensive side first. And I think they took a look at that roster and decided that that's the way they wanted to go with the personnel they had, and it's been working for them. But certainly very slow to watch, and having played in it, it's not the system for me.
So how do they set it up positionally? The one, is that the center then?
It doesn't necessarily matter. Usually, so if it's a neutral zone face-off, let's say it's at any of the four dots excluding, or it could be the center too, they'll have a winger that pushes, which is usually mm-hmm. the left side. So the left side will push off a loss. So he steers, and then the left side defenseman just curls up and makes the three line.
Okay.
So that's usually off of stagnant forechecks. It's usually one of the wingers that will push. And then it's basically just dependent on the setup. It depends on who is where, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a center. It can be a winger. But off draws, I think we were pushing right side. So on losses, the D just jumps up. Mm-hmm. And it's, like I said before, it is something you practice, and it is something that all five guys need to be in tune with each other and need to work as a tandem for it to work. And it works brilliantly when it does. You'll see them. They just sit back, steer, force a dump, and then Doughty is sitting all the way back at the hash marks in his own end. And just, he'll either turn and wheel it straight up, or he'll go for a skate, and it's quick transition. And before you know it, it's in the back of your net.
So how do you beat a 1-3-1?
You skate. And I don't want to make this sound bad about Vancouver, but I don't know why they haven't figured it out yet, because Quinn Hughes could be a huge cog in that. If you watch Edmonton do it, Draisaitl has started to do it really well. It's skating, and it's not dumping the puck in far. It's close chips with support. So as soon as you get over the red line, you can send the puck down if you're getting steered off. But a lot of teams like Edmonton will double swing, so they'll have two guys going with speed. But you can't send the puck all the way down so the goalie's going to play it or the D can play it. You have to send it in that quiet area between the D and the wall of three. Leon has kind of figured it out. Connor loves to skate, and Leon will usually be the guy that, kind of cruises up, soft chip to area, and Connor at full speed is there. I think they have a lot of guys in the Canucks lineup that can do that. Hoglander's one that I could really see them exposing it. The other way is changing sides right away. So instead of doing a same side dump, you just fire a hard rim around, and that basically bypasses everyone, and then you send a winger to the other side. So it's something that's not, it's not unbeatable, and it's something that you have to sit there, definitely watch some video. You got to see it from above. Well, that's one of the things is, you'll play it during a game, and me as a player, I would play it and not exactly understand it if we were trying to play against it. But then you do the video next day and you get the camera angle from above, and then you can see where the areas are. So that's something that in practice you would go over. You'd have, five on five, the other team kind of plays dummies, and you set up how they set up, and you just work on solutions to beat it.
Scoring first, I imagine, would be a big theme in any series against the Kings. How would the system change based on, like, let's say you found yourselves down a goal in the third period. Do you still play that system, or do you completely abandon it because you need to force some things?
If you're LA, we would change a bit, and they do change a bit, where instead of just being more passive, this is even getting like super hockey specific. They'll call it a 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
So the second guy, if he has a jump or he thinks he can get it, you just play on the more aggressive side.
Right.
Instead of automatically thinking to defense and to being on your heels, you rather have your guys on your toes.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll make that switch, and they'll make that adjustment usually going into the third. I remember Todd walking in and saying, okay, we need to be a little more aggressive here. That's kind of the way it works, because you basically can't sit back the whole game. They'll start sending guys, they'll start being more aggressive. But what they like to do is send guys high too in transition. So as soon as there's a turnover, their guys are gone. Their wingers are gone. And guys like Kempe and Trevor Moore, who has been outstanding this year, even the new Akil Thomas loves to fly as well. They'll just send their wingers to speed. So a team like Vancouver has to be super aware of them sending guys in behind them.
So what do you think the Kings think about playing that system? Like, I was just thinking in my head, boy, as a beer league winger, I love that system. I don't have to forecheck. Awesome. That's exhausting forechecking. But like, if I'm a highly paid professional athlete that loves to get in on the forecheck because that's how I got to the NHL, I don't know how much I love that system.
I think they take a lot of pride in it. I know Drew Doughty had that quote the other day about, you know, getting guys were frustrated about it, but I think it's, people talk about it, like I said earlier, about it being like this revolutionary kind of system and everyone's having trouble with it, but these are the best players in the world and the best coaches in the world. You should be able to watch pre-scout on them, watch clips from their last five games, go out and practice that day or a couple days before, and you should be able to execute. It's not something, like I said, that's unbeatable, but I think they take a lot of pride in playing that way. And LA just gives me the sense of a team that is, I was just going to say, a team that is a team. Like a team that really leaves their egos at the door. And I'm going to float this conversation back to Pierre-Luc Dubois and earlier in the year when Drew Doughty, again, who was very outspoken, was saying that guys are more focused on points in this dressing room. And that spoke a lot because he never talked like that in previous years. And what changes did you have on the team this year? Who did you bring in? Like, there's a common denominator there. But it just seems like a team where you drop your ego at the door, and no matter what you have to do for the team to be successful, they do it. So whether that's a guy scoring five less goals a year, he's okay with doing it because he knows that the system works and he knows that they'll be in the playoffs if they play this way. And once you get in, anything can happen.
That probably goes back to Daryl Sutter coaching them, because I remember Drew Doughty having quotes like that before, or even Daryl Sutter. I think he threw Brian Campbell under the bus once when he was like, you know, like, you can have lots of points as a defenseman, and then, you know, what are you if you're not playing defense? And then he was like, oh, you're Brian Campbell, who's playing in Florida. And Campbell was like, wait, what did I do? But Drew Doughty, I think, you know, bought into that way of, you know, I could go out there and I could pile up points if I played a certain way, but I want to win a Stanley Cup. And the Kings did win a couple of Stanley Cups under Daryl Sutter. So you've got those leaders on the team like Drew Doughty and Anze Kopitar who know that sometimes you have to sacrifice your individual point totals for winning a Stanley Cup. Do you find that that's typically like a common denominator of the teams that win the Stanley Cup? Like, they will have that. Like, how do you become a team like that?
I think you're right in saying that Sutter probably still has some lingering influence there. I think it starts from the top. And, you know, we've talked about Drew Doughty. You just mentioned him. Heck, he's leading the NHL in ice time for any player. He's playing 25-48 a night, which is insane. I don't want to say he's old at his age. We're the same age. But it's impressive to be doing this at that point in your career. But for me, it's Kopitar too. And I've had the chance to work with Justin Williams on the Monday Night Hockey panel now for a while. And hearing him talk about Kopi behind closed doors and even on the camera, we did their game versus Vancouver a couple weeks back and spoke on him and did the talk back interview. And then I just got to listen to Justin talk about him as a player and as a person and how much influence he has there. And basically, you know, what he says goes. And a little more quiet, but everyone kind of just jumps on board. And man, he was the guy for me. I tried not to get starstruck very often because at the end of the day, I was playing in the NHL and I didn't want to be intimidated by these guys. But there were a few where in warm up, you know, I used to stretch up the red line every time to do my little intimidating thing, right? You know, try to let the team know I'm there. And Kopitar was one of those guys who did a wheel by me and I was just like, holy crap, like, that's Anze Kopitar. And he was way bigger than I thought, too. I have to say that. He's just an absolute unit.
Yeah,
like, I just remember being like, this guy's as big as me. Like, this is insane that he's doing that at that size. But hearing Willie talk about him and watching the way he carries himself, I think the influence starts there. And he is a huge, huge factor in the way that team plays. And yes, they have a bunch of youth that's coming up now. But I think it still starts and ends with guys like Kopi and Doughty and even Trevor Lewis, who's back there and won twice with them as well. So it always starts with your vets in the locker room.
Hey, Luke, who's your pick right now for the Hart Trophy?
Oh, man. I'm giving it to Nate right now.
Yeah, us too. I think we're all on Nate's side, I think.
I mean, I watched the game on Sunday versus Minnesota. He's a man on a mission. I think he's partially going to – I don't want to say the sympathy vote from the Hart voters, but I think he is going to get some of that he's never – he's been around it before, but he's never won. I'm not going to lie. It's not just because I live in Toronto, but I'm starting to fall on the Matthews train. Like, it is overly impressive what he's doing in terms of goal scoring. I thought Connor was there for a while, but I think just even being injured for a couple games might take him out of it. And I just am not sold on Cooch. He has, I think, 53 points more than the next guy on his team now, which is insane. But you factor in all these things, the empty net points and secondary apples, and he's only a +6 and all this other stuff. I just think from start to finish, what Nate has done in Colorado has been just so overly impressive. And he's just such a dominant factor in every game that I watch the Avs play. I know Makar's there and Rantanen's been outstanding, but this guy can do it on his own. And I think he deserves it.
What's it like being on the ice with guys that can skate like MacKinnon and Connor McDavid and Quinn Hughes and all these these incredible skaters? Like what MacKinnon was doing the other night, I don't know if I've ever seen anyone skate like that in the NHL. Well, I mean, I have, because I've seen Connor McDavid skate.
Well, I'll tell you what, if as long as our coach had our matchups, I wasn't on the ice against him very much. But every now and then you did get caught out against him, right? And you got to do a job. I'll never forget my first game in Denver. And I think I was finishing a change, but it wasn't a very long shift because they had sent Nate's line out. And so I couldn't just sprint off the ice. And I went at Nate full speed in front of the Avs bench. Full speed, and he was stopped, full stopped. He was not moving, and he reverse hit me, and I'm 6'4". I played at about 230, 235, and I went straight down to the ice. Like, he sent me down so fast, and I lost my wind. We're already in Denver, so I couldn't breathe already, and I just remember I was right in front of the bench, so I took 3 steps to the bench, and I just remember sitting there just being like, holy, like, that was hard. That was a hard hit. But you see, Nate and Connor are different. So I get to practice with Connor every single day. So it's not like I'm taking him out of this. It's just I almost got used to it. Connor would do stuff in practice that people didn't get to see, right? You see him in games. But I saw him do things like that on a daily basis. And for him, it's the edge work, crossovers, his ability to handle the puck while his eyes are still up. and do everything at top speed. Nate is just so powerful. And when you see him start to gallop, I guess we'll call it, because it's not even a crossover, it's like a full gallop, and he starts to get going, when I'm sitting there on the bench at ice level, it is, there's nothing like it. Mm-hmm. And he's just so strong on his feet, so dominating, so powerful. And sometimes I found myself just watching. I think that was like the coolest thing about playing in the NHL, to be honest, was I had the best seats in the building. I know I self-deprecate sometimes, but when I played, you know, 5-6 minutes a night and it's a 1-1 game in Colorado, I'm not playing, right? So I get to sit there and I have the best seats in the house to watch Connor and Nate go head-to-head. And it was some of the funnest memories of my career, was getting to watch some of those top guys, you know, in pressure games, third periods, going for the win. It's pretty cool stuff.
Another great chat, Luke. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll chat more as the playoffs are coming up real soon. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with all these teams we're talking about.
Yes, sir. Big one Saturday. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, anytime. Luke.
Thanks, Luke. That's Luke Gazdick, former NHLer, now Sportsnet NHL analyst here on the Halpern and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
That must actually be pretty fun if you're one of those players that's like not going to see the ice in the final 5 minutes. You're like, wow, these are great seats.
Yeah, give me some popcorn. I don't have to worry about anything.
You should have tried scalping these.
Yeah, you go up
awesome.
And try and hit Nate McKinnon. He's like, gives you a reverse hit, and while you're going to the ice, you're like, can I get your autograph?
Yeah. So he's on.
That was amazing.
This has been a lot of fun, sir.
This was amazing.
So he's on board with Nate Dogg as MVP too.
Yeah.
And if I still had a vote, if it wasn't coldly and callously ripped away from me from Frank Saravalli and the Professional Hockey Writers Association, I would have a tough time. I would have a very tough time with it, because the one stat that jumps out to me in terms of most valuable is the fact that Nikita Kucherov is like 50 points clear mm-hmm. of the second leading scorer on his team. To me, that is the statistic that's most indicative of most valuable.
Yeah.
That you're that far ahead and you're not on a bad team. You're on a playoff-bound team. But don't get me wrong. I've got plenty of time and reason to argue for McKinnon to be the Hart Trophy winner. You know what? This isn't just me putting it on for the show. I genuinely have no idea how it's going to go. This is the most perplexing, confusing, deep, and interesting Hart Trophy race of all time. Because I would say there's five guys that probably could get first-place votes. Mm-hmm. Maybe not necessarily deserve them. But Kucherov, McDavid, McKinnon, Matthews, and I will say Sidney Crosby, I bet they all end up getting like first and second place votes.
Yeah.
And that's kind
of
unheard
of. Well, if the Penguins make the playoffs.
Which
if
I think
not,
they're going to do.
Yeah.
They got the vibes going on right now.
I just don't trust the Penguins.
Which
is crazy to say, but watching them last night blow that 2-goal lead against Detroit, you're kind of like, man, like you can't do that at home.
So I know
we can't do that at home.
I know we're up against for time. Nothing about the Penguins really makes sense. Like I was watching that game and Jeff Carter is scoring shorthanded breakaway goals. Jeff Carter is like 65 years old. He's the same age as Bruff. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, how is he doing this? And they get out to these huge leads and they look great for 5 or 6 minute stretches. And then like the goals that they gave up to Detroit, for blowing a 5-3 lead in the third period at home, they weren't even like greasy grinding goals. They were giving up like clear-cut breakaways to the Red Wings. Like mm-hmm. they just completely lose the plot or collapse defensively. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're 7-0-3 in their last 10, so they're getting it done. But they're shaky. They're a shaky hockey
team. One thing they showed against Detroit, I think, was their lack of speed, because Detroit has plenty of speed.
Slow.
They've got like the young legs, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's why Jeff Carter going on a breakaway was so hilarious.
I was like, how'd he get there?
Yeah, it evolved not in real time, in slow time.
You're listening to the best of Halford and Brough. You're listening to the best of Halford and Brough.
It's time for Rick Dolly Wall. 8:04 on a Friday. Happy Friday, everybody. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Brough of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. We are in hour three of the program. As the music suggests, Rick Dollywall is going to join us in just a moment here to kick off hour three. Hour three is brought to you by Campbell and Pound. real estate appraisers. Trust the expertise of Campbell & Pound. Visit them on the internet at campbell-pound.com today.
We are coming to you live from the Kintech studio, Kintech Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for?
Kintech, final hour of the program. It's a Friday. That means Rick Dollywall from Donnie and Dolly, Czech TV, here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. What up, Rick?
What's up, boys? What's up?
Rick Halford slept in this morning, so I had to do the first 15 minutes of the show by myself, and a lot of it was spent on the word uncertainty as it pertained to the Vancouver Canucks. There's uncertainty when it comes to their playoff opponent. There's uncertainty when it comes to their forward lines. There's uncertainty when it comes to when Thatcher Demko will return and whether or not he's going to have enough time to bring his game back up to speed. Which of the uncertainty storylines would you like to start with?
Oh man, you nailed it. There's a ton of them. I want to start with Demko because as I said yesterday, very early in the process when he got hurt, I was told the last two regular season games were the targets for Demko, not the Edmonton game. I was always told, no rush, he's got to be 100% be ready for the playoffs. They had a plan and they were going to stick to it. But if the Oilers win tonight against Arizona, does that change things? Is that enough to rush him in? Now, if you rush him in and he gets hurt, imagine the outrage in the market. If Calgary next week was the date all along, they should stick with it. He hasn't had a full practice with the team where he could get, you know, game-like situations, battling traffic, you know, good quality shots from the top guys, stuff like that. The 30 minutes he did get in for practice was at an optional. So, but one thing we can all agree, Demko's return will be welcome. Canucks went 6-5-2 without him. They gave up 3 goals per game without Demko. If he doesn't play in Edmonton, who do you go with? DeSmith or Seelaws? I don't know about your show, but we had some texts yesterday on our show criticizing Tocchet for starting Seelaws in the last two games. He does tend to let in some soft goals every game. He is still young, and he's still the goalie of the future. We all get that. I do expect the Canucks to check in and see what it would take to re-sign DeSmith. I really do. I think they're going to take a crack at him to see if they can bring him back. Well, we realize that, you know, a veteran backup is very important in Vancouver for Demko's rest and for quality minutes when he gets injured, like what we're going through in the past month. So it'll be interesting to see who will back up Demko next year. But what happens in goal tomorrow night, guys, is going to be fascinating for me.
The line juggling. You know, we've talked a lot about where you put Garland and Joshua. Do you have them with Miller, or do you let them run a line for themselves, essentially, if you want to put it that way? What do you think about all this line juggling? Because it looks like against the Edmonton Oilers that it could be Elias Lindholm between Joshua and Garland, and then you would reunite Miller and Besser, and he'd be with Pugh Suter, and then you'd have Pettersson with Hoglander and Mikheyev.
He's now got Mikheyev of the one goal in the past 47 games, Suter one goal in 30, and he was a healthy scratch last week. Those guys are both back in the top six. And now you fight so hard to get a top six winger at the trade deadline. That's why. You know, people, I will say this about Lindholm. People complain about his lack of offense. Last game he was with Mikheyev and DiGiuseppe. Garland's been driving play of late. Would love to see him try and get Lindholm going. I think that line's got a bit of everything. You've got the face-off guy, you've got the penalty killer guy, you've got the defensive guy in Lindholm, and then you've got, you know, Joshua and Garland, who all season long have been a really good duo together. So maybe that gets Lindholm going. But my concern is we got 3 games left. You'd like to see some chemistry with the lines at this time of the year, especially in the top six. You'd like to see at least one line going into the playoffs that is gelling and producing. That would be nice, but we don't have that right now. But at least the blue line is set in terms of consistent pairs, but really worried with the, you know, the lack of one line. We're a week and a half away, essentially, from the playoffs. I mean, and we're still juggling bottom six guys into the top six.
You can see what Tocchet is thinking, though, because I think, in my opinion, the Canucks were at their best when it was Garland and Joshua
And Bluger
on the third line. If you want to sub in Lindholm, they didn't have Lindholm at that point. And if you want to sub in Lindholm for Bluger, that's fine, I suppose. But when they have the top six as it's been constructed for the past few games, it does look a little top heavy. And you look at the bottom six and you're kind of like, like it's better than it has been, I suppose, the last few years, but it still looks like just a mishmash. And, you know, I think Tocchet himself, and he's talked about this, he knows, like, you need to have at least three lines going, preferably four, to do anything in the playoffs. So I can see why he's tempted to go back to Garland and Joshua on that third line.
And, you know, here's the other one for you. When Demko returns to the Canucks lineup, they are going to be 100% healthy. So there's no, like, you can't say, oh, he's juggling because, you know, remember last year, this time, the Canucks had like 9-10 injuries. They got Lindholm back. The only guy injured is Demko. When he comes back, they're going to be 100% healthy. I mean, this is it. This is your group of forwards. But I wish that one line can get going here and heading into the playoffs, and they can just say, you know what, we got one line going, we got the third line going, but it just seems to be just a blender every day at practice. And at this time of the year, you'd like to see some stable lines for sure heading into the playoffs.
Rick, tell us about Sawyer Mineo.
Oh, I thought this was really interesting last night. 18-year-old kid from Kamloops, third-round pick last year. Mineo made his pro debut last night with Abbotsford. Not many kids at junior finish their season at 18 and get a chance to play pro, especially with Abbotsford playing important games and with playoff implications. They put him in the lineup last night. Tells you what the franchise thinks of him. The Canucks really, 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 really like this player. He never came off the ice in Seattle this year in the Dub. Talked to a few scouts in the Western Hockey League last night. They all feel the Canucks got a steal of a pick with this guy at the draft. NHL teams shied away from Mineo last year because he didn't have a ton of offense in his draft year. But look at this year. 53 points, very good defensively, fearless when getting pucks. Skating got better this year. Last year, he was the number six defenseman in Seattle. No power play time. This year, he ran the power play and excelled. Even in his Western Hockey League Bantam draft year, he went in the third round because he was hurt a big portion of the year. Teams didn't really have a lot of viewings of him in the Bantam draft that year. But this kid keeps getting better and better. One scout told me last night, he thinks this kid's going to get to the NHL quicker than most people think. It's a good story. BC boy. And with Willander and Mineo trending the right way, it will help last year's draft look a whole lot better down the road, because this is the draft that Buskevich was in, and the Canucks gave up on Buskevich. But boy, if this kid can step in and make it someday, that'll be good. The other thing is, he is a left shot, he's not a right shot. One more Abbotsford note, Jet Wu, freak injury last weekend, ankle, 4 to 6 weeks. That's a tough break for that kid. Tough break.
What's going on with the Canucks prospects at the Frozen Four?
Okay, I just got some. Let me tell you, Tom Molander and Aiden Celebrini are out. Boston U lost to Denver last night in overtime. Jacob Truscott, I am going to tell you right now, I told you guys a few weeks ago the Canucks are not going to sign him. Fifth rounder in 2020, checked in last night. Nothing has changed there. I did get some fresh news on Malone, Jack Malone. Boston College. I was told a few days ago Canucks were not going to sign him, but when I checked in this morning, I was told that he's not even property of the Canucks anymore. Malone was a sixth rounder in 2019. They didn't sign him last year, and he's not property of Van. He's filed his paperwork. I think he's a free agent, and so he can pretty well, if after the championship game tomorrow against Denver, Malone can sign with anyone in the NHL. But I was told a few days ago that the Canucks were not going to sign Malone, and then when I checked more into it, he's not even property of the Canucks, I was told this morning. So that's an ongoing story. I will tell you this about Willander. Great first year at Boston, 20 minutes a night, power play two. If Lane Hudson signs in Montreal, which I think a lot of people expect here in the next few days, Willander should move to power play next year, power play one next year. Willander's now going to sit down with his family and his advisor, Todd Diamond. They're going to reassess the year. Plan was always minimum 2 years in college and go from there. There were no talks with the Canucks about signing after this year for Willander at all. So he's going to go back next next year, and this time next year, when Willander's season is over, he will sit down with his family again, and they'll discuss possibly signing him then.
Rick, do you think the Canucks are going to hold on to first place in the division?
Well, they had a 17-point lead. They're in this mess going down to the wire, and they have to look at themselves. Since the All-Star break, they've been playing 500 hockey, right? And so let's say the Oilers win tonight. So tomorrow is a massive game. It's obviously – and the Oilers' schedule, let's be honest. I mean, they got a lot of San Jose, Arizona in there. So, look, if they blow it, they got to look in the mirror. They had a 17-point lead. Everybody thought they would coast to a division title. This one might go down to the wire. It's tough to say right now, Jason, but they have put themselves in this position, you know, because of the fact they've been playing 500 hockey since the All-Star break. One thing I want to – I heard you two talking, and I'm going to agree with Holford on this. I heard you two talking about Hanifin's contract and if it affects Hronek. You know what? That's $7.3 million for Hanifin. And I know Hanifin's left shot, Hronek's right shot, I get it. But, you know, career high for Hanifin, 48 points. Career high for Hronek, 38. He's at 48. I agree with Holford. There's no defenseman in Vancouver. They should get a penny more than Quinn Hughes. Hughes has got 91 points. How can anyone on this blue line? And Hronek's at 48 points, but the bulk of his points were in the first half of the season, not the second half. I just don't see a world where a defenseman in Vancouver can ask for more than Hughes when Hughes has got 91 points.
No.
I agree with Holford.
Did you even say anything about Hronek?
Damn straight, Rick. Me and you will stick together forever. That's right, buddy. I don't even know if I said that. Attaboy, way to go.
Holford, don't you even listen to yourself? You said that. I was driving in my car, for crying out loud.
You know what? I don't remember it, but because you got my back, I'm gonna stick with it.
No, you said that no defenseman should make more than Hughes, and I agree with that.
I've said that a million times on the show, and you've never, you know, given me a standing ovation.
Holford said it. He knows what he's talking about. He's a good guy.
God, it's always yelling at me. And
In our building, more people in our building like Holford than Bruff. I'm sorry, but
that's fair.
More Holford guys. More Holford guys.
Like that's fair. He's less intimidating, right?
Same
you
here,
guys are
too,
intimidated
Rick.
By
Same
my
in this
intellect.
Building.
More Holford guys in this building than Bruff. Take that to the bank.
Yeah, that's like most buildings. Okay, Rick, we got to let you go.
I'm sorry that Alan Walsh hasn't been replying to your text, too.
Okay, bye.
See you, Rick. Buddy. Rick Dhaliwal, big Halford guy here on the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. I still don't think I said that. I think what I said
Halford's
was...
Halford's huge at the Donnie and Dolly studio.
I was like, also, isn't there three people in your building? What is it like? I got two-thirds of the vote. And one of them is
I thought I had the Hendo vote, though, for sure. Yeah.
So back to that conversation, all I really said was if he was to get Hanifin's deal,
Tradio.
He wouldn't be making more than Quinn Hughes. And maybe I threw in one of my little jabs, which is right, because no one should. But to circle back on it, I don't think that any Canucks defenseman should make more than Quinn Hughes. It might happen.
So someone texted in, that's the stupidest argument ever when Hughes signed 3 years ago. Yeah, I know, but still. Like, that's my retort to that.
Yep.
Even if Hronek could go out and get that, even if he could reasonably argue to make $8 million a season, my retort is, yeah, but still.
Yeah, it's like
he's not, no. Nobody should be making more, especially on the back end, nobody should be making more than Quinn Hughes. Just period. And you can say he signed it 3 years ago, totally different market. He wasn't the player than he was at that point. And then Hronek is worth what he's worth. Then trade him. Like, I'm sorry. Like, my retort is yeah, but still.
It's not
the best retort, but it's the one I've got.
No, but there's that scene in The Sopranos when Tony's trying to get the sign off to whack Phil Leotardo. And New York gives him the sign off. And then he's like, now I need a location. He's like, I can't go there. And that's exactly what this is. It's like, we can do certain things with Hronek. Mm-hmm. But the moment that you ask to get paid more than Hughes, the retort is, we can't
so
go
you're
there.
Saying the Canucks yeah. need to you just whack can't. Hronek?
Is that well, that's
I mean,
the
if it comes to
it.
That, right?
Yeah. Right? You either keep him or you well, whack
Hronek's
him.
Just going to say, see you later.
Sorry?
Hronek's just going to say, see ya.
I know, mm-hmm. but that's inherent in when you throw out a blanket statement like, I can't go there. So
just be prepared to
and
say,
and someone texts in, you know, and it's the same person, then how do you retain good defenders? Yeah, it's tough.
It's tough.
It's tough, but you know, I don't think you can afford to overpay Philip Perona. Go get other ones.
Utah will give him the money.
That's very possible.
They're going to be
actually.
Big spenders.
Damn,
apparently.
Utah. Yeah. Cursed yard. They're already getting my goat. I don't like them. Okay. I want to do a couple Ask Us Anythings going into Ask Us Anything Friday here. We don't get a lot of fashion Ask Us Anythings for a variety of
Why?
Reasons.
For a very good reason.
For a multitude of reasons. However, I flagged two in a row. So one, I flagged some stuff. Two, I think these are ones that we could handle capably. Okay? You guys ready for this?
Okay.
So V-Dub from Van with the first Ask Us Anything from the fashion realm. Longtime listener, first-time texter. What's your guys' protocol for mixing and matching activewear? By this, I mean, is it okay to wear multiple fitness brands at once? For example, logo mixing Adidas and Nike. Short answer, no. I'd never do it.
You lost me at activewear.
Sorry?
You lost me at activewear.
You have some activewear.
Do I?
Yeah, but your activewear has like pictures of.
But I'm not active.
Yoda.
It's sweatpants. It's kind of activewear, right? Yeah. Don't you have to be active in the wear for it to be active?
Yeah,
you have like children's activewear. It's like, oh, is that Joe Fresh?
Yeah,
hey dog,
that's really nice.
Some LA lights.
Yeah, there's like it says like Space Camp 1986 on it.
Yeah, exactly.
It. Yeah.
And you're still holding on to that shirt, eh? It's really tight.
So you do have activewear.
Circulation.
Mm-hmm. So pursuant to this text. Worse than mixing and matching brand logos is someone showed me a picture of the very first sports trip that I ever went on. We were 21
oh,
years
no.
old.
What did you do?
I was wearing, it's crazy. I had on
were a. Were you wearing like a Charlotte Hornets hoodie with.
Philadelphia Phillies hat, Chicago Cubs shirt, yikes. And Arizona Wildcats basketball shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, and it was, the colors kind of were in the same shade,
mm-hmm.
but it was is the word garish or garish?
garish.
Is it garish or garish?
Sloppy, I would just say, right?
No, because it was jarring the amount of colors.
Oh, okay.
Because they're all bold.
Right, yeah. It was garish, yeah.
Yeah, there's not a lot of like professional sports teams that go with like lighter tones. Like
this was the
all...
90s though, right? So, garish was in.
It was early 2000s, okay. But it was
garish you'd more apply as a word to something that's like expensive though.
Okay, this
you
wasn't
know, like
expensive.
Flashy and expensive. It's a little garish.
Yeah, but point being, don't do that. There's going to be some people out there that are going to wear two sports teams at once.
Mm. Well, I like them both.
Yeah, don't. You can wear one on one day and one on the other day.
But I don't think you should have like themes. I think you should try and limit your, unless you're going to the game and you get a Canucks hat and a Canucks jersey, that's fine.
That's
but
fine.
If you're walking around in like themes.
Like yesterday.
Like, do you play for the team? Like, it's a, I think in everyday wear, you should limit your gear to one item. Maybe
it's like
it's,
bands
maybe
that wear their own merch. I always hated that.
Bruff is trying to become a tracksuit guy. So, and this is good because this will tie nicely into our next text.
It's auditioning for the Russian Mafia.
Yesterday, you wore Adidas pants and a Nike top. I almost said something.
I'm like, really?
Yeah. Like, you can't.
Well, I had just gotten out of bed.
I know. That's the thing.
And they're tearaways. So.
Yeah. We should bring back tearaways.
We should have
Halbro tearaways.
Okay,
anyway,
so
the next one here.
Mark at the office with go. An Ask Us Anything. Yeah. What is a normal age to lose all sense of fashion? I ask as it pertains to Jason Day, who has quickly gone from a stylish golfer in his 30s to an old man wearing pleated trousers from Tip Top Tailors and personalized sweater vest designed at the Dog's Ear at Capilano Mall. What a look he has at the Masters. Yeah, Jason Day yesterday was wearing...
What is going on?
I actually thought he had rain pants on. I thought that's what he had. I thought he had his wet weather gear on. And then I was like, wait a minute, wet weather gear doesn't normally come with a belt.
He was wearing
like hammer pants.
The pants were crazy.
Because they were blowing in the wind and it was super windy at Augusta yesterday.
So here's my theory on
and
this.
And then Tiger's out there in his Sunday red stuff,
okay.
Which looks like Nike stuff.
So my theory on this as it pertains to Mark's text.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this, as you get older, and there's a bunch of people right now that are going to be nodding along as I say this, fashion that makes sense and is logical and is conducive to weather and seasonal, it suddenly
takes... The more pockets, the better.
It takes on a whole new... Like, you will look in yourself in your mirror and you're like, I look like trash, but it's functional.
And I don't care.
So Jason Day's pants might, like, he could have had, like, those would have been good golf pants. He's got, like, I had some tees.
I think there was a big pocket there. Wasn't there?
Yeah, there's a sandwich in there. There's
a scorecard in there.
Right?
A scorecard, yeah. You've got some of the guys have a notepad.
Right.
You can bring their notepad along.
When you go to a store and you look at tactical cargo pants and you're like, I could see myself wearing those. that's when you've reached a problem. Now, we also had this issue when we used to be big fans back at the old 1040 days of the New Balance Air Monarchs. Sorry, the Nike Air Monarchs, not the New Balance. The Nike Air Monarchs, made popular by Pete Carroll, because Air Monarchs were the cross trainers for dads. You could barbecue in them. You could mow the lawn in them. You could take the kid to hockey practice in the morning and then wear them out as a fashion statement.
Walking on air.
You were just doing the business in those, right? Mm-hmm. That was where functionality surpassed fashion. And I feel like that's what Jason Day has kind of hit at the Masters here.
I thought he was like trying to bring something in, though. Like, he's like, get a load of these pants. These are the next big thing.
Well, so a lot of people were talking about the sweater vest that he was wearing.
Mm-hmm. Which, I didn't even notice the sweater vest.
Well, here, I'll show you right now. It's got the world's biggest logo on it. It's just huge writing. It's just huge writing across the front of it. Yeah. And I don't know what
it
is.
Did he get that at Winners?
That was in, you know, when Winners, which is a discount rack store.
Dude, I worked there for 5 years. That was my first job.
Really?
In high school, yeah. Worked at Winners and Park Royal.
So the clearance rack.
Did you feel on a day-to-day basis like life maybe was getting tough?
It was. I got to say, the music in that store, it sucks your soul away.
How many items have you folded?
Just a lot of stuff is hangers at Winners.
Yeah,
honestly,
wasn't the most engaging gig in the world.
I'll go to Winners once in a while, and I'll have a little peruse. I'll take stuff off the hangers, and I'll just huck it.
Yep.
One of those guys.
Take seven things.
Because I know
there's a
young A-dog there.
Jerk. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
So Winners is essentially a discount rack as a store, right?
Yeah.
And then
stop trying to slag.
I shop there all the time. What I'm saying is,
I got all my socks there.
Yeah, there's a discount rack in Winners, which is like the discount rack's discount rack. That is, there may not be a better bang for your buck for clothes if you can find something. Like, it might be a quadruple XL Carl Kanai sweater, but it's $5. I'm like, you know, I can make that work.
You know what's been sad about going into the Winners the past 5 years? You were like, a lot of Canucks gear in here.
There's a lot of Canucks gear.
I saw
a
lot of Reebok.
Jerseys. I saw a perfectly good, not worn, not returned Elias Pettersson jersey in the discount rack's discount rack. Mm-hmm. And that was not great.
I took it off the hanger and just hucked it.
But I still went with the Carl Kanai sweater after all that.
How many players on that Coyotes team are going to be like, you know what? I didn't sign up to live in Utah.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to Utah, some disrespect to Utah.
They're a little bit inherently.
But I don't really want to be part of this organization anymore if it means, like, I just don't want to, that's not what I signed up for, so trade me.
But that might even work in their advantage as well.
No. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad or whatever.
Oh, I know.
All I'm saying is, like, there's the potential for the Utah whatevers to be major players in the offseason.
That's kind of what I was alluding to.
Yeah.
Like, that may work to everything that's on the table right now could either work against Utah or work in their favor.
They should, by the way, you know how it's kind of funny that it's called the Utah Jazz?
Yes.
Like, you don't think of Salt Lake as like the jazz capital of the world, and that's because they moved from New Orleans, right?
That's correct.
Okay. It would be funny if they went with another like very anti-Utah, like, what would that be? Like the Utah Brewers? Something like a drinking connotation, or just like or you can, you know how they have names like the Miami Heat?
Yes.
You know, how about like the Utah Sex?
Utah Abstinence?
You ruin things. No, the complete opposite.
Something that is the antithesis of the city and the state.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz music, not exactly prevalent in Salt Lake and Provo.
But they just kept the name.
So,
because the
abstinence
team moved.
Isn't either, since it's a breeding ground, as you said. So,
well, that's true. That's true.
My humor is too smart for you guys, I think, as well.
Well, that was 4D.
And you're not even like, I'm thinking 10 moves ahead of you.
But that's, no. Abstinence is a huge part of the culture there, because you have to.
But you just say that they're always breeding kids and stuff. There's always
when
kids.
They're married. What do they do until they're married?
Yeah,
they
but it's
abstain.
Not like
yeah. So like, you can't say that it's not a huge part of the culture.
Utah abstainers.
No, you got it. We really need to get off the abstaining part, guys. I feel like we've missed the boat. He had a good punchline because it was also singular.
The Utah sex.
No, we got
can
your
you
attention.
Imagine? Can you imagine the beginning of the games and Please welcome to the ice, your Utah Sacks.
You can have shirts that say congratulations on the Sacks.
Yeah.
That would be a good one. Yeah, there's lots of opportunities here. Okay, we're going to get serious here, folks.
We probably aren't.
No, we just named the team the Utah Sacks. But coming up on the Halford
first overall draft pick goes to the Utah Sacks.
Congratulations.
I want to hear Bettman say it.
He's like, why? You know what? I'm just going to retire.
You know Bill, what? You guys are going back to Arizona.
Bill Daly, this is your job.
You're listening to the best of Halford and Brough.